Moncrief on News Talk.
For the first time, a piece of Lego has gone where no building block has ever gone before. A Lego figurine has gone into space, garnering a Guinness World Record in the process. Dr. Chris Rose is head of projects at Sent Into Space. Good afternoon, Chris.
Good afternoon, Sean. Thank you for having me on.
I'm taking a wild guess here, but based on the name of your company, you do this kind of thing a lot.
You'd be quite right, yes. Essentially, in a nutshell, we design craft that are purposed for the objectives of our client. 95% of the time, it's an advertisement objective. So in this case, it was send our beloved Lego set high above the Earth into space. But in other cases, it might be to activate some kind of theatrical feat for the purposes of showing off the functionality of a device or anything, really.
Mm. No, because you did, and we will get to the Lego in a minute, but you did manage somehow to send a bottle of champagne up and it popped it open in space.
That's right. I mean, I suppose when we approach any project, there's a tremendous amount of variables that go with that. We're going to be sending that product, that service provision, or that demonstration of something, whatever it is, into very harsh environmental extremes, minus 70 degrees Celsius, zero pressure, aggressive re-entry speeds into the Earth's atmosphere. So we have to spend a lot of time thinking about pretty, sometimes mundane items, but how they will react in this very unusual environment. In that case, you know, we didn't want the bottle of champagne to pop itself too early on its trip into space. We didn't want it to come back down to Earth having not popped. So we need to think about careful regulation systems that will allow some sort of pressure feedback to do what it needs to do at the right time, but not too early.
Yeah. So how did you get the champagne to pop when you wanted it to?
Well, the simple answer to that is we let nature take its course, because we were able to work out the maths of, you know, if this travels from the pressure we would experience on the Earth's surface all the way into the vacuum of space, we can do ground-based testing to essentially pull corks out of similar bottles, see what kind of force it would need to extract that, and basically draw lots of plots to say, well, this is the altitude that the maths demonstrates that should happen. But that doesn't actually take into account confounding variables such as, well, what if we get to 20 kilometers up and the bottle shakes itself, gives itself an extra boost of energy, and all of a sudden that internal gas wants to go. So in our line of work, Sean, we do get a lot of confounding variables we need to consider.
Yeah. And one I would imagine for a Lego figurine is how is it going to react to that kind of temperature?
Well, temperature is really important. You're quite right. It's an important consideration for a lot of what we do, because the temperatures, whilst they might not compromise the bricks themselves, you know, if these bricks were sort of encapsulated and like a smartphone would have capacitors inside that are closed off vessels, if you like, these kind of things don't like being in the vacuum of space. They tend to explode or fail. But Lego bricks, let's face it, they're designed to last generations. You know, kids play with them, grown-ups play with them. So there wasn't too much could go wrong with the actual functionality of the feature item itself. However, if we were to, say, have some sort of structural reinforcement here to make sure that no components come off, which of course was very important to this client, we need to make sure that that doesn't become embrittled or fail due to the very, very cold temperatures of space. So we need to make sure that we restrain everything in a way that makes sure this is safe and reliable. But we don't want to overwhelm the feature setup. We want to show that floating in space in all its glory.
Yeah, now, because looking at the picture anyway, Chris, it just looks like the Lego piece is just standing on a platform. It doesn't seem to be encased in glass or any protective material at all.
Well, I guess the tech team did their job well. That's exactly what they would want you to think. You know, you might say the similar thing about if we had a burger floating in space, but what you might find is under the upper part of the bun of that burger, there's lots of structural restraints holding everything in place. Fortunately, Lego, it's a very organic product. It's very light in as much as, I mean, it's traditional. You can see its form. All we needed to do was give it a helping hand in terms of its stability, make sure it was like properly affixed to the base with a little bit of a helping hand up the back to make sure that when this begins its return journey to Earth and we get those very arresting forces of the parachute deployment system coming into effect, it doesn't whip it and then a small piece break off. So we just need to take care of the very vulnerable parts of the structure.
Yeah. So to ascend, it's basically a huge balloon. Is that the case?
In many cases, and in this case, we have access to a whole host of space vehicle. If we want to put something in orbit, such as satellite technology, we're going to have to utilize our rockets to get that kinetic energy. But if we're doing a PR exercise where we want to get those beautiful views of the Earth, we don't want to be shooting anything through a porthole here and capturing fleeting views of our planet. We want to show that that item floating high above the Earth in exposed space. So for that, we would utilize our space-capable balloon systems. And very similar to Felix Baumgartner's jump from space with Red Bull, it essentially utilizes the buoyancy of lighter than air gases such as hydrogen or helium, and that can take our very large balloons, which at the top of the flight, this balloon would have been larger than the White House because of the extent to which it expanded due to the pressure difference, and that carries our payload. In this case, our payload was whatever craft we designed to present this in the best way, house our cameras, all the tracking systems and all the safety equipment that goes with it.
Yeah. Now it gets up to 20 miles or so. And then how do you arrest that ascent? Does the balloon naturally pop itself, or do you have a huge space needle that you stick into it?
Both, actually, both. You know, what we do have is, what we want to do is to get as high as possible. So we want to allow it to run its course naturally according to simulations that we find favorable. We don't want this to land in any populated area. We don't want this to go into the off the coast into the sea. It makes operations a little more difficult. But the higher we get, the more beautiful it looks. And all around, that's better. Now, what we can rely on is that we can very accurately predict the failure criteria of the balloon, i.e. we put X amount of gas in there. It should be able to travel at Y velocity to achieve Z altitude before it cannot expand anymore, and it will naturally fail. We design our balloons to fail in such a way that they don't contribute to any littering. They sort of de-envelope, if you like, and open out. Everything returns to Earth in one piece. So we don't leave anything in space, and we don't leave anything on the Earth. But having said that, back to your big needle poking the balloon, you might describe that as our fail-safe safety mechanism. So we're in real-time communication with all our craft, and we're watching the live feed of everything from the view to data to positional. And if we don't like the look of anything, if this is not doing what it should and what it's simulated, we do have override technologies that can decouple portions of the all the aforementioned, bring this down to Earth much earlier and under our control.
Yeah, and so then when the balloon pops or ceases to expand, when does the parachute open? Is there a period with which it's just tumbling back to Earth?
Well, you're quite right. The parachute does deploy almost immediately, but there's no air there to act against that parachute. So even with a deployed parachute, this will be traveling back down to Earth in the many hundreds of miles per hour. It's only when we get down into the lower, thicker portions of the atmosphere, often referred to as the troposphere. That's where we find our weather systems, our clouds, our winds, our rain, and all the rest of it. Once we get down into the troposphere, that will have a suitable air pressure to act against that parachute. And ultimately, this will land at a very gentle walking pace, exactly where we've simulated it to land, and our recovery team will be there with open arms waiting for it.
Okay, so and its descent is calculated rather than, can you control it to any degree once it starts coming down?
We can control it, but what we try and do is to not have as many heavy systems on board as possible. So we do have some control systems that essentially operate a little bit like a parafoil, like a parachutist would control his parasender back down to Earth. We have systems that can work off GPS and buy us a return journey should we need them to. But we'd only normally use them if, say, we've done launches in the Emirates or in places where you've got a lot of controlled aerospace from the military. We might want to launch from a certain area, have it go up to a certain altitude, return to a certain altitude, but then avoid certain areas on its re-entry. If we don't have those constraints in place and we like the look of the simulation that we're presented with, you're better off removing them, saving weight and getting extra altitude.
Yeah, now it's obviously a low Earth orbit that you send, or it's not even an orbit, but just it's low Earth that you send them up to. Do you need permission to do that? Is there kind of like an air traffic control for satellites that you have to make sure you don't crash into anything else?
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, you need a lot of permissions when you're doing a drone exercise, and you certainly need a lot of legal permissions to do what we do. I think more than that as well, like to be dealing with large scale projects, the health and safety of the public, all of these things, you need a tremendous amount of insurance to be able to do what we do. But ultimately, when you talk about orbit, we go to fantastic altitudes that deliver these incredible views. Without rocket technology, we'd probably be hoping to achieve close to 40 to 45 kilometers above the Earth. Things start to look, the entry to the first region of space, often referred to as near space, is the Armstrong limit. That's 19.2 kilometers above the Earth. We go much higher than that. We go to more than twice that altitude with our balloon technology. Things start to look really beautiful at around 25 kilometers. That's where you get that nice pronounced curvature of the Earth and blackness of space, and the atmosphere is reduced down into that nice blue vibrant band. But when you talk about orbit, we don't have any need to be going over the horizon like our rockets would, but we are able to traverse the Earth should we need to. But what we would do is we would implement our pressure regulation system into our balloons. Some of our balloon systems can carry several tons in weight. 3.5, 4 tons is about our maximum weight carrying capability. And what we can do there is we've got enough freedom of weight to have pressure regulation systems in the neck of the balloon that when it's getting a little bit too engorged because of the pressure difference, we can just let a bit of gas out, which what it does is it allows it to sit at a peak altitude rather than continue to failure. That way it can go all the way around the Earth several times before we retrieve it, should we need it to.
Yeah. And the Lego piece, how long does it take to get up and how long does it take to get down?
Well, we want to move very quickly with a lightweight setup that was traveling up to space at a pretty rapid pace and returning much quicker. All from release to peak altitude, we're only talking about an hour and 45 minutes and about 45-minute return journey.
Wow. Does it land very close to where it took off from?
You know what? It can land tremendously close to where it took off from, having gone several hundred miles. That's the interesting thing about flight paths. It might be that this goes all the way off the Welsh coast, all the way back over off the East Coast, and then come back to a central location, landing ultimately perhaps 30 miles away from where we launched from. But I would say, from past experience, we would expect sort of to be recovering this 150 to 200 kilometers from wherever we launched from, unless we're doing this from our Swedish launch site where we can see much more prolonged flight paths.
Now, the piece itself was a model of Ryan Gosling in Project Hail Mary. What happens to that now, or what has happened to it?
Well, it's actually still in my possession. I'm looking at it right now. And I would expect that the client might want this back. Or perhaps Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the directors, might want to get their hands on it. So I'm kind of waiting for the phone to ring to let me know what to do with that item. But until then, I can look at it every day and enjoy that project.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a million for speaking with us today. That was Dr. Chris Rose there, head of projects at Sent Into Space. Cormac says, I think Space Lego could really take off because there's no chance of stepping on it. Yes, I suppose that's true.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.